evening, everyone. It's good to see everyone here. We have quite a number of visitors with us this morning. It's a great honor and privilege to have you with us, and hope that you benefit from your time with us in our study of God's Word together. Before we get into the lesson of the hour, I'd like to make mention with regard to the illness that I had last week. Several have asked concerning that. My initial impression was it was the same ordeal that I went through last time about this year relating to some kind of an insect bite. I went to the doctor on Monday morning, and he confirmed that, in fact, it was not a bite of any kind, but some kind of a skin infection that had just started to run away, and he gave me some antibiotics and knocked it out, and I feel fine right now. So I'm thankful for that, but it's not the same kind of thing I went through last year. But also in regard to that, I want to single out Larry for acknowledgement and thanks here. It's a pretty tough call when you pick up the phone on Saturday and find out the preacher's sick. You're going to have to fill in. And Larry just jumped in there and did it and did a fantastic job, and I really appreciate him for doing that. This congregation has a lot of talent like that, a number of people who can and are willing to step up and do what they can to help. And then that's a great testament to the character and the quality of the people that make up this congregation. And I salute Larry and I salute all of you for the efforts that you make in those regards. But now let's turn our attention to this passage that was read in Hebrews chapter 12 a moment ago, verses 3 through 11. The dominant theme in this passage is, of course, what is referred to as the discipline or the chastening of the Lord. In order to understand the meaning of this passage, we have to look at it in its greater context, of course. It's in the book of Hebrews, which was written to a group of Jewish Christians who, throughout the course of their time in trying to serve God, had become discouraged in that effort. They apparently were bearing quite a burden in trying to maintain this faith and in the face of a great deal of persecution and problems, and they were frankly just getting tired of trying to live this life of faith, and they were ready to quit. And the book of Hebrews was written to these people to encourage them, don't quit. You're so close. You're so near to the end goal here. Don't throw it away. And so this discipline of the Lord is set within that greater context as words of encouragement to try to get these people to hold fast to that they're struggling with. And, of course, in this context, by using this expression, the discipline or the chastening of the Lord, he is referring to a metaphor to describe what it is that they are going through and why it would be so foolish for them to quit. This concept of the Lord's discipline is one that is well known. We use that language quite often. But I feel that oftentimes we fail to really appreciate what this discipline of the Lord really is. And in fact, even attach an erroneous meaning or definition to it. And in doing so, we rob ourselves of a valuable resource, I think, in helping us to deal with the obstacles and the hardships that we encounter in this life. Now, the approach that I'm going to take in this study is, first of all, to look at some clues that we find within the text itself. There are five things that the writer says with regard to this discipline of the Lord, whatever it is, that I think will help us narrow down what it is the author is referring to. So let's pick these up one at a time. And then as we accumulate these clues, hopefully it will help us come to a clearer understanding of what this discipline of the Lord is. First clue. In verse 11, notice that the writer says that this is something, whatever this discipline is, it is not joyful for the present, but painful. In other words, the discipline of the Lord hurts. It's not fun to go through this. So this is not something that we can just flippantly pass off as no big deal. It's a very big deal to whoever it is that's experiencing it, and that's going to be you and me. And in fact, that brings us to the second clue that we see here. If you'll glance back at verse 8, he says, if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers. In other words, this discipline is not unique just to us who are believers. All of us, everybody, deals with this discipline to one extent or another. Now, it's left undefined at this point as to what extent some may experience it as opposed to others, but it's going to be pretty much universal across the human race. All of us are going to experience it in one way or another. Let's spend some time talking about the third clue found in verse 6. This is actually a quotation from the book of Proverbs. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. The motive for this discipline being applied to us is not anger. It's not God's wrath that we are experiencing. In fact, the writer specifies here, it is God's love. It is precisely because God loves us that he administers this chastening to us. Now, it's interesting that in this context, he goes on in verses 7 and 8 talking about what son is there whom a father does not chasten. He's clearly relating this discipline of the Lord, whatever it is, to the discipline or the training that a father administers to his child. Now, let's pause right there for just a moment. This tells us that whatever this discipline of the Lord is, you can't describe it as God flailing away at somebody in holy anger with a razor strap. He's just lost it. And he's just letting us have it. That's not what is being described here. It is something that he carefully administers in order to mold our character. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. But what if you, as an individual, did not have a father who carefully, lovingly administered discipline as a child? I suspect that this metaphor that the writer is using here is a little difficult to figure out. It's a little hard to grasp and understand and appreciate what he's describing here. So all I can do at this point is just ask you to try to envision that you did have a father like that. I don't care what kind of scoundrel or rascal your father may have been, what kind of discipline unfairly he may have administered to you when you were a child, or in fact was one of these fathers who administered no discipline whatsoever. Whatever the circumstances of your background, I want you to try to envision having the kind of father that the writer is describing here. One who administers the discipline, the training, the chastening, out of a motive of love. He's doing it for the child's good. Try to envision that if you can. And before we leave this point, I'd be remiss if I did not draw out this other ancillary lesson here, particularly for the fathers in the group. Do you get some hints here in this language as to what your responsibility is as a father toward your children? If you really love your children, you are going to chasten them. You're going to discipline them. It is a false love that says, I love my children too much to inflict any kind of harm or discomfort on them. I'm sorry, that's not loving your children. That's letting them go wild. And there's no good that's going to come out of that. As father, it is your responsibility, it is your job to set the rules and to enforce the rules. And when a child chooses to break those rules, you have to step in and deal with it. Now you do so not out of anger, not out of hate, but out of love. You genuinely love the child and you want what's best for them, and you are, in fact, molding and shaping their character through that very discipline that you are administering. So, that's the third clue that the writer gives for us, and that is that the motive is one of love. But look down again at verses 10 and 11, and you see that there is a fourth clue that the writer gives here, and that is where this discipline leads. Speaking again of our earthly fathers, they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but He, that is God, and the discipline that He administers, He does this for our profit, that we may be partakers of His holiness. He goes on, the last line of verse 11, to say, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The outcome of this discipline, whatever it is to make us better, stronger people. As a result of going through this, we tend to be less selfish. We tend to be more loving, more patient, more what God wants us to be. And it is the very process of going through the pain of this discipline, whatever it is, that brings us to that point. And this is not just some, if it happens, then this is the result that comes from it. The author is saying here, it's essential. It's a necessary part of our growth and development as the people of God to go through this. Notice, if you will, the word that is used. That last line in verse 11, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The old King James Version has the word exercise. They're exercised by this discipline. The Greek word that's used here is the same word from which we get our English word gymnastics. This discipline we're to think of as a pretty tough workout, if you will. It is something that God is using to put us through our paces. It's a training regimen that helps us and develops us and strengthens us and makes us the kind of people that He wants us to be. We've covered four clues. There is now one last clue I'd like for us to notice that the writer lays out for us. And that is the fact that we have a choice as to how we respond to this. That outcome that we just looked at, that's not guaranteed. And the reason it's not guaranteed is because I have a choice, you have a choice, as to how we're going to respond to this discipline that we are experiencing. Notice in verse 5, he said, "My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord." It's entirely possible for me in experiencing this discipline, whatever it is, to react to it with anger and hostility. I can become bitter at God, at life, at the people around me, at all the circumstances that contributed to this pain, whatever it is, whatever its source. And I can just turn against it. I can reject it. I can, in His word, I can despise it. And if that's my reaction to this discipline, then all bets are off. The strength, the training, the development that the Lord intends that I receive from this discipline, that's all wasted. That's all out the boards. But that's my choice, isn't it? Now there is another choice that I can take. Look in verse 9. He says, "Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live?" That's the other choice that's available to me. When I experience this discipline, again, whatever it is, we haven't defined that yet, I have the choice of saying, okay, this doesn't feel very good, but there's got to be a lesson here for me. Somewhere in the midst of all of this pain and heartache that I'm dealing with, there's something that is going to benefit me. What is it? Where can I find it? And how can I find it? We have the choice of either turning our back on this discipline or accepting it for the good that God intends that it accomplishes in our lives. But that's me. God is responsible for everything else up to that point. But I am responsible for how I react to what God has brought my way. So then, that poses the question, what is it? What is it that we experience in this life that fits all five of these criteria that we can describe as the discipline of the Lord? Now, some believe that the discipline of the Lord here are specific punishments that God metes out for specific sins. For example, I get up one morning on the wrong side of the bed, and for whatever reason, the day just doesn't start right. And somewhere in the course of my early morning preparations, the wife and I have a falling out, and I yell and scream at her, and I stomp out the door and slam the door behind me and get in the car and head off to work, and I have a flat on the way to work. But what's the first thought that crosses my mind? Well, God must be punishing me for those hateful words I said to my wife before I stormed out the door. Now, that may be the natural reaction to a very bad series of events to start your day. But is it rational? Not really. There is no logical connection between hurtful words I spoke to my wife before I left and the fact that I had a flat tire on the way to work. There's no causal relationship whatsoever. There's no connection there. And you're really putting yourself way out on a limb to argue that, well, God must be punishing me because of, you know, something that I did. And I fear that that's the kind of reaction a lot of people have to a lot of bad things that happen to them in life. They try to find some kind of connection to some wrong that they've done somewhere in their life. Now, let's be sure. There's no doubt that there are some things we experience in life that do have a direct connection to misbehavior on our part. If I choose to get drunk and go out in a car and get in a wreck and either injure myself or kill somebody else, yeah, there's a direct connection between a bad decision that I made and the outcome of that decision. Certainly that can apply in some cases. But you can't say that every bad thing that happens to me in life has some kind of relationship to something bad that I did. You'll recall that this was the very argument that Job's friends made concerning him and all the sufferings that came upon him. Remember in the first two chapters of the book of Job that we're introduced to Job and all the travails that came upon him. The fact that Satan took away his children, took away all of his possessions, his flocks, finally took away his health, even his own wife, told him to curse God and die. He had nothing left to live for. The worst possible nightmare you could imagine, it all came upon Job in one fell swoop. And the rest of the book of Job is the dialogue between Job and his three friends trying to unravel why. What has happened to cause all of this horrible suffering to fall down around Job's head? And Job's friends have it all figured out. Eliphaz, the first one to speak right at the beginning of the book, he really sorts it all out for Job, does he not? In chapter 4, in verse 8, he observes, "Those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." Now that's his basic theology. When it comes to the question of suffering, Eliphaz has just a very simple explanation. If there's trouble in somebody's life, you sowed some seed somewhere that caused that to happen. And so then the application in Job's case is, well, you've done something to bring all this about. And it's interesting, in chapter 5, in verse 17, and this is Eliphaz again, still speaking, trying to explain to Job why he is suffering so badly. He says, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty." That language is almost identical to what we're looking at here in Hebrews chapter 12. curious. So that pretty well nails it down, doesn't it? Any kind of suffering that we experience in this life, according to Eliphaz, is because I've done something to deserve it. And that suffering is just simply God's way of getting me back in line. And if that's the case, then as Job's friends did with him, the task is to find out, okay, what's the sin? What's the terrible mistake that I've made in my life to cause God to come down on me so hard? And of course, if you read the speeches of Job throughout the book, Job initially accepts this explanation, but as he goes through, he racks his brain, his memory, trying to figure out, what have I done to deserve this? Of course, you and I were told in the first two verses of the book that Job is innocent. He hasn't done anything to deserve any of this. Remember, he's described as a righteous and faithful man, one who feared God and shunned evil. So we know from the very outset that Job didn't do anything to deserve all this suffering that came upon him. And so for Eliphaz to make a statement like this in chapter 5, that Job, you better not despise the chastening of the Lord. You need to submit to Him and confess your sin. It just misses the mark entirely. Job didn't do anything to deserve all the terrible suffering that came upon him. But while we're on the book of Job, even though Eliphaz's description doesn't really fit the situation that he's trying to make it fit, I think the story of Job does nevertheless bring us a step closer to understanding what the true discipline of the Lord is. I'd like for us to consider momentarily the parallels between Hebrews 12 and the story of Job. Remember the first clue? That the discipline of the Lord is painful. Was Job's experience painful? You bet it was. It was horrible. I just can't imagine experiencing the kind of loss and pain that Job must have felt in losing all the things that he lost on that occasion. Yes, it was painful. First clue fits. Remember also that the second clue is that this discipline of the Lord is not unique to believers. And as you go through the book of Job, Job himself acknowledges the fact that other people experience bad things, not just the wicked, but even righteous people sometimes experience these things. And Job now has himself as a case in point. It's universal that terrible things happen to people, good or bad. And as he comes to the end of the book, Job comes to realize and accept that fact. So the second clue fits Job. We also know that the third clue fits Job as well. Remember, the motive is love, not anger, not wrath. And throughout the book, especially in the first couple of chapters, God points to Job in the presence of Satan and says, there is a good man. God loves and respects and appreciates Job. Anything that happens to Job in the book is not as a result of God coming down hard on him. It's because God loves Job. In fact, before the book ends, God rewards Job several times over for his faithful patience. So this third clue fits the story of Job. The fourth clue, the outcome. Remember, the Hebrew writer tells us it's for our profit, that it might make us better, stronger people. And how many times in Job's monologues as he's describing or wrestling with the meaning of this pain in his life, does he talk about, as he says on one occasion, though he try me like fire, I shall come forth as gold. I'm going to be a better man because of what I'm going through here. Did he understand the why and wherefore behind all of the suffering and tragedy that come upon him? Nope. Never did figure it out. But he knew what the outcome could be. And that brings us to the fifth clue applied to the story of Job, and that is he had a choice. as to how he's going to respond to it. Do you remember in the first chapter of the story of Job, where we have this discussion between God and Satan? And again, God points to Job as an example of a good man, and Satan just basically blows it off and says, the only reason that Job is serving you is because you've given him everything a man could ever want. You take all these things away from Job, and he will curse you to your face. And he asked the question, will a man serve God for nothing? Will a man serve God for nothing? That is the question that is being answered in the book of Job. Now, Job doesn't know that. He has no idea, again, what's going on behind the curtains. He just knows what's happened to him right now. And despite his ignorance of knowing what is going on, he still insists, I will continue to serve God no matter what. That's Job's choice. He's not despising what's happening to him in his life. He's instead looking at it as a means, an opportunity for becoming a deeper, stronger individual. Which, in fact, is how it turned out. But that was Job's choice. All five of the clues fit the story of Job. But let's carry it one step further. Look at the life of Jesus. You see the same elements. Did the experiences that Jesus dealt with in this life, were they painful? Yeah, especially those last few hours here upon this earth. They were horrible to go through an ordeal like that, this crucifixion. Were the kind of things that Jesus had to suffer typical of what a lot of us have to deal with? Yep. There's very much in Jesus' life that was, in fact, perfectly parallel to things that you and I have to deal with all the time in life. Now, granted, most of us will never end up being crucified like he was. That was pretty extreme. But there are other pretty horrible ways to die as well, right? The terrible diseases and illnesses, the horrible tortures. I mean, there are just all kinds of ways that we can encounter our end and everything leading up to that. Did Jesus suffer because of his sin? Now let that one sink in. We want to define the discipline of the Lord as God punishing us for terrible things that we have done in our lives. Did that apply to Jesus? Well, of course not. Jesus didn't deserve a thing that happened to him, and yet God let it happen. Then the fourth clue. What was the outcome? Look in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 8. The writer tells us that Jesus learned obedience through the things which he suffered. Have you ever thought about that statement? Jesus learned obedience through the things which he suffered. You mean to tell me Jesus had to learn how to obey God? Well, he didn't do it by trial and error, if that's what you mean. No. He always did it correctly. But he learned the meaning of obedience. He learned the significance of it. He learned the cost that's involved in obeying God perfectly. He never made a mistake. But it was precisely because of the things that he suffered that he learned this is what it means to obey God. And so when God is telling humanity, obey me, Jesus can say, this is what it feels like to obey God. Jesus became a better individual. He had a deeper appreciation of what it means to be subject to God, to be a fellow member of the human race, to go through what you and I have to go through. That makes him the perfect advocate, does it not, for you and me when we stand before God on the day of judgment. He's been there, done that. So yes, what Jesus went through, the suffering that he went through, had a positive outcome for him. And finally, did not Jesus have a choice as to how he would respond to the suffering that hit him? Remember one occasion Well, actually, there's several things we could point to here. But think of, for example, when Satan tempted him. Satan threw several things in front of Jesus, and the source of the temptation was to try to get Jesus to take a shortcut around all the suffering. If you'll fall down and worship me, I'll give you the kingdoms of the world. And you don't have to go through the pain of the cross. That was a choice that Jesus could have made. I don't have to deal with this mess. I don't have to go through all of this for these people who are so unworthy of it. I've got a detour here that I can take. Or remember in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus told Peter and the others, "Do you not know that I could call on my Father and you'd send 10 legions of angels right now to rescue me?" He had that option. And it would have rescued him from all the suffering and all the pain and everything that he was going through at that point. But he wouldn't do it. He remained in subjection to his Father, even though that subjection meant that he suffered in the process. So then, with these two examples of Job and Jesus before us, we can pose the question, what is the discipline of the Lord? It's not any specific tragedy that may hit me in this life, but instead it is the sum total of all the pains, all the heartaches, all the losses, all the betrayals, all the temptations, all the trials, all the illnesses, all the tragedies, all the things that we experience in this life that make us want to throw up our hands and quit. It's not worth it. Or, God, why are you letting this happen to me? Reasonable question, but it doesn't really address what's in front of us, does it? You see, the discipline that the Lord allows to happen to us in this life is just anything that is unpleasant and uncomfortable and painful in this life. Be it big or small, be it related to something we've done or totally unrelated to anything we've done. It makes no difference. Everything that we describe as the human condition, that is the discipline of the Lord. And the Lord is not going to protect us from all of this junk. He's going to allow us to experience that. Think about it. I don't know about you, but I have weaknesses that I need to work on. I have flaws in my life, in my character, that really need to be fixed. I have bad habits that need to be replaced by good habits. Does any of this sound familiar to you? If it does, then stop and think about it. How's God going to fix that? How's God going to work in your life to help you overcome these problems, these weaknesses, these flaws that you know that you need to fix? That's what we've been talking about this morning. It's through the discipline, the chastening of the Lord. Just like Job, God exposes us to hard knocks that have the potential of forcing us to confront our shortcomings and come to Him seeking help. And that's how we become better people. That's how we come to develop this crystal clear picture of where I am and where I need to be and what it's going to take to get from here to there. Man, there's nothing like suffering to really give you the acuity of vision to know what you ought to do with your life. You know one reason we have so much trouble becoming the better people that we know we ought to become? It's frankly because we have life too easy. Why should I bother? I have a place to live. I have clothes on my back. I have food to eat every day. I have cable TV. I have a car to drive. I have a job. I have friends. I have good health. Why bother? How big a deal is it after all? And it's not until we get slapped hard in the face by some kind of tragedy or disaster or suffering that we really wake up and realize, man, this life is short and I'd better deal with it. That is the discipline of the Lord. Think, if you will, of Paul's thorn in the flesh. This is in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And look at what Paul says. He describes this thorn in the flesh. And as we read this, I want you to think of some kind of problem, disaster, crisis, pain in your life. Now, we have no idea what Paul's thorn in the flesh was. That's not really relevant right here. What is your thorn in the flesh? Whatever that is, I want you to take that and plug it into the verses that we're about to read. 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 and 10. And God said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Paul figured out that it was the very problems and sufferings of this life that made life so difficult that were the means of his strength. It was the means of making him a better person. But again, that was his choice. When life throws you a nasty curve, you have two options. Option number one, you can get nasty back. You can get bitter. You can get angry. Angry at God, angry at your parents, angry at those around you. You can become depressed. You can become overwhelmed with remorse and self-pity. That's one option. And a lot of people take that option. Or there's another thing you can do. There's a second option. You can ask, what can I learn? What can I do with all of this suffering and this pain that comes to me in this life to make me a better person? How can I apply this? Some time back, I ran across this little picture that I thought just perfectly captured the essence of what this statement in Hebrews 12 about the discipline of the Lord is all about. It's kind of cute, but the meaning and the message is deadly serious, and I hope we'll all spend some time to think about it. You can either go cry in the truck or cowboy up. Now, isn't that a pretty good metaphor for life? And I think it's appropriate that this picture is based around this little boy. Because you stop and think about it, each one of us is a little kid lost in the woods. And life is so hard. It is so painful. It is so difficult. Yeah. Either go cry in the truck or cowboy up. Deal with it. It's not because God hates you that He lets these things happen to you in your life. It's precisely because He loves you. But it's up to you to take these painful things and to turn them into something positive and make them help you be a better person. Your choice. God can't do that for you. So don't despise the chastening of the Lord. Cooperate with it. Allow it to mold and to shape your character as the Lord intends. If you're here this morning and you need God's help, the truth is, He's been trying to help you all along. All the things that have happened to you in your life that you've been so upset and mad about, step back and look at it differently. It is God trying to shape you, mold you, train you, exercise you to be a better person. But you've got to open your eyes and your minds to accept it. If you need to respond to the Lord's call this morning, we encourage you to come forward and express your need as we stand and sing.
While Jesus whispers to you, come, sinner, come. While we are praying for you, come, sinner, come. Now
Prayer. Before he leads that prayer, are there any announcements that we're overlooking?